Please join me in welcoming our speaker today, Tom from the Primary Purpose Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina.
You tempt me. thanks very much. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And I am a member of the Primary Purpose Group at AA in Southern Pines. Amy was asking me about if it's all right to record. I said, it just depends on where you play it. Yeah, it's a strange thing about this technological revolution that what can happen today is that you can record something in Portland today and play it in Beirut tomorrow. And it's amazing how that genie's out of the bottle. And I've always used my full identity in AA because I don't want to be anonymous with my family. But it gives you pause when you recognize that it may show up on eBay tomorrow or God knows what. So it is a little bit of a dicey situation. I'm going to keep doing it till somebody puts a net on me. Now, I'm delighted to be here. I got a real challenge this morning. One, I think slow and I talk slow, and I've got an awful lot to cover. Normally, it'd take 3 or 4 hours, and I'm going to try to get at it hot and heavy. And as fast as I can, may not make sense. But I ask about this because I'd like to move in case folks start throwing chairs or something. I like to be mobile. I can't tell you how good it is to be here. I left the airport in North Carolina yesterday, 104 degrees. Man, I stepped out this morning. I thought I was in heaven. I was out walking, didn't sweat, didn't pass out a single time. This was just wonderful. I am delighted to be here. Got a lot of friends here, and it's super to be back. What we want to talk about, I want to, in a way, it's kind of like how you recover from alcoholism. First, you got to face some grim stuff before you can get into the celebration of new life. And the same thing in the content of this workshop. We'll talk about a little heavy going, but what I want to do is my goal is I don't want you to leave here heavy laden with feeling a sense of despair and hopeless. What I'd really like to do is to have you leave here inspired to do something in the place you stand, wherever that is and whatever it is you can do. And I say that because it's sometimes it is when you get into the infighting and the thing and sort of take a look at the state of the art in the fellowship, it can cause you a lot of concern. Now, I'm going to make an assumption. I will also assume that it's probably wrong, but I'm going to assume that this is a group who are not in just the don't drink and go to meetings category. I'm going to assume that you're a group that have done some step work. I'm going to assume that you've done enough step work that you've gotten to the point where you understand that it's not all about you, that it's about how to be of maximum service to God and those around. And so I'm going to assume that. And assuming that, it kind of gives me a little more comfort to talk about the kind of stuff of trying to enlist you into trying to deal with things that may be a little problematic in the program. So with that little brief introduction, by the way, I feel kind of bad that my boss is up here all suited up like he's preaching. If you put work in front of what I'm doing, I'm going to roll up my sleeves, because this is work time. I'm not going to preach. It'll sound like it, but I'm not. What I want to do is take a look at the state of the art in our fellowship as a whole. Now, I'm into my 51st year in the program, so I've observed a little bit of it. And I have observed some changes, and a lot of people ask me how it's changed over the years, and it has changed a considerable amount. And some of it is good news, some of it's bad news. And maybe share a little of both. I'm going to have to just cut right to the chase, and that back until we started to encounter formal treatment, in this world. AA was a different animal. You could safely say, almost without exception, that every member of Alcoholics Anonymous was a member because another member reached out to them in unbelievable circumstances and gave that hand of welcome, gave the support, gave the guidance, gave the introduction, gave the identification and affiliation. You could safely say that nobody came in here just because it was a good idea, because some nice person told them we ought to go. That all of us came in from a point of desperation and because of the good graces of another member, called 12-step work, called sponsorship. And when treatment emerged, that scenario changed. And what we started, nobody intended it to be this way. Nobody had a plan of action for it. But what happened, when treatment started to emerge, people started to come through a new portal of entry. They came from a different place. And some of us didn't deal very well with the change. And what I'm talking about is, when prior to treatment, you only got one door here, that's in case you were looking for a quick way out. There's only one way to go. But if there were another door, what happened when treatment emerged, we were used to alcoholics coming in that door. But when treatment emerged, they started coming in the door over here where Paul's sitting. Well, we didn't like that much. We kept looking at that door. And no drunks coming in. They're coming in over here somewhere. And rather than being real thrilled about that, we didn't adapt to it very well. We didn't get to a point where we recognized, and I think it was a great failure on our part, we recognized that alcoholics were coming from a different place and a different point. And the problems that ensued were owing to our failure to respond far more than anything outside of us, far more. Because what we did was, if we do something one time, it becomes a sacred tradition, no matter what it is. And so we had certainly a well-established sacred tradition of one-on-one sponsorship and working with people and all this kind of stuff. You okay, love?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, good. Don't you faint now. That just tears me up if people faint. I always think I'm Benny Hinn, and they just laid hands on me. Yeah, okay. I just have an effect on people. But what we did, we didn't react well. We didn't respond and adjust our observation. We didn't adjust our strategies to deal with a new reality. And so we didn't adapt very well. We didn't accommodate it. We didn't welcome people in. We didn't pick them up from where they were. We treated them as if they ought to be where we used to be. And so we developed some real trouble there. And a couple of things that are significant happened in that. One, the whole ethic of 12-step work and that kind of preliminary sponsorship into AA started to wane. And started to move toward almost disappearing. You could pretty safely say in the city of Portland, Oregon, or most any other city, 80% of the membership has never participated in a 12-step call, either as a provider or a consumer. It's almost a lost art. It's almost a lost ethic in terms of how we function. And so it was a huge, huge change in that sense. And people started, when treatment caught on, when some money became available to start making treatment available, man, I'll tell you, talk about a growth industry. That really was a growth industry. There was huge need for it. And I, for one, was deeply grateful that it came into being. I'm one who does not yearn for the good old days. And for my money, anybody that yearns for the good old days either wasn't there or has a lousy memory. Man, it meant something to me to see alcoholics treated with dignity in decent surroundings. Man, that was like a dream. That was like Portland weather. That was a dream come true. As I was thrilled and delighted. with the emergence. And when the money became available, it just exploded. And I never thought I would see it, but there was a time in my lifetime in this country that treatment was available on demand to almost any citizen anywhere in the U.S. of A. Now, that's a far cry from where we were 70 years ago. So it was a huge change, and there was huge impact for that. The influx into AA was unbelievable, that we were just overwhelmed. You know, all of our active outreach, that's not a common term that we use, but our active outreach, you know, the go-get-em syndrome, you know, that started to be unnecessary. You didn't need to go hunt drunks. My God, we're running over with them. You didn't have time to unload the bus of the ones coming in. And so that whole business of active work and reaching out to people, you know, started to become unnecessary. And we were just overwhelmed. I'll give you one. I've got to watch about giving examples because I could be here all day. But one example, in my little old town, I live in Mayberry. Well, not really, but it looks like Mayberry. I got a call one day from a guy who said, we got a problem, Tom. And they had started a new group called the Newcomers Group. Well, Newcomers Group is like manna from heaven to a treatment industry. Because, my God, that's an answer to prayer. And so they started the group about three or four times. And the night before this guy called me, a bus pulled up with 41 people on the bus. There were four members of the group. They couldn't even welcome everybody, much less serve coffee. And so the guy called me. He said, what are we going to do? I said, my God, man, your prayers are answered. You started a newcomer group. You got newcomers, man. He said, who's going to feed them? I said, don't worry about it. It'll work out. But see, that was what was happening. We were just sort of overwhelmed with a new reality. And what happened is that when these treatment centers came into being, any time a treatment center developed in a town or a city, the number of AA groups would double, almost overnight. And they started to take on a little different characteristic. Now, think about the contrast between brought in by somebody who, in my case, fished me out of a rat hole or fished me out of a jail and then kind of lovingly sat with me, helped me get over the trembling and shaking and all this stuff, and then helped me understand how to spell AA and then gradually get introduced, eh? Yeah, what a difference. What a difference. When... Now, you got people who miss that whole experience. So how do they get acquainted with AA? How do you understand the valuable principle of identification? You know, is that an ideological or an intellectual process? Yeah, I would submit that it's not. It's a spiritual kind of kind of phenomenon that happens when somebody bears their soul to somebody else. It shows about where they were broken and healed. And so that whole piece of the puzzle started to be gone. And so folks started to come in, and this avalanche of new members and new groups created a phenomenon that's dominant in this country today. And this was meetings that were essentially a gathering place for whoever came. Yeah, but in fact, I'm going to leave with Chris. A buddy of mine just wrote up. I just got it, but a buddy, I'm going to leave because he's got a lot of stuff, and he'll make copies for the entire world if anybody wants to take a look at this thing. So I'll leave it with him. He'll thank me profusely for that too. Well, yeah, right. But anyway, that. Now, what happened in this thing, the meetings almost started to become a forum type of thing for sorting out who fits and who doesn't and how do you accommodate this and how much do you flex that, so that it led to what my buddy called everything anonymous. Good term. Because a lot of these things, you go to them and you can't tell. It looks like Noah's Ark. You got one of every problem syndrome in the world gathered under one flag. Well, that's a nice social thing, I guess. But what does it do in terms of the effect on the program? It's a troubling kind of concern. So that's the sort of thing that occurred and goes to this day. My deal, I don't have a board or anything. Just imagine a board. If you wanted to draw a scale, you bear in mind that the definition of a group in Alcoholics Anonymous is about as loose as it could possibly be. So when I talk about a group and a meeting, I sound like I'm talking about two different animals. Not necessarily so, because the definition of a group in AA is two or more alcoholics gathered for the purpose of recovery can call themselves an AA group, as long as they're not hooked up with anybody else. I don't know why that was important, but it is. That's the definition. If you and I want to go out in this parking lot and form a group today to attack the cause of intergroup in Portland, Oregon, we could do that. We're free to do it. We got no police force to come rock us up about it. So we could do it. It doesn't matter. It's best if we're not negative, and that may have a little traditions trouble. But nonetheless, there's no criteria for group. As long as you're meeting for the purpose of recovery, you can call yourself a group. And so there's not a stringent definition. But I tell you what I see happening in the country today is that those kinds of meetings that have been going on for a number of years, and they've been proliferating for a number of years because they're attractive. They're really attractive. They're no real challenge, you know. A lot of people make a steady diet out of nothing but just going to meetings. There's a saying that's caught on in this program. You won't hear me saying it, but you'll hear this saying that how does the program work? Don't drink and go to meetings. I would submit to you that that's a dangerous misrepresentation. If we're dealing with a killer illness called alcoholism, that kind of marching order may contribute to the fact that we have a higher suicide rate in early recovery than we do in active alcoholism. This illness is far too serious for that. Meeting makers make it. That a lot of things catch on that, in keeping with that. And these gatherings are extremely popular. Because they're done all times of the day and night. I guarantee you in Portland, Oregon, this morning there are probably 15 meetings going on. At 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9:02, on and on. They tend to be at the level of convenience. And they're not challenging. They're basically go in and get what you want and boogie. No real commitment. They'll tend to be very unstructured. They'll have few, if any, officers. You talk about rotation, they'll rotate very quickly. And tend to have little, if any, connection to the fellowship. And what I mean by that is that a typical group, if it's structured and purposeful and designed for a to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, will tend to have connecting factors to the fellowship as a whole, like a general service representative, will tend to show up in a group. It won't tend to show up in just a casual little gathering. And so what that produces is a collection of alcoholics who have no connection to the fellowship they claim. It's sort of a free-floating group of people who come together, enjoy a conversation, probably do no harm, and they go their separate ways. Very popular, very handy, very easy to do. Happy hour meetings. That even sounds enticing to me. I never have been to one, but well, I have too. I've been taken to one, but that'd be fine. They're handy. You catch them on the way home from work. brown bag meetings. That's what we used to do in North Carolina to keep from selling liquor by the drink. You talk about dignified liquor. Take a brown bag, go to the country club, carry a brown bag into Drake whiskey. That would almost make me quit. But anyway, that kind of thing. So you got a whole bunch of stuff like this, and they're popular, highly popular. Probably they are the dominant AA entity in this country today and growing like a house of fire. There are vast areas of North America that don't have a well-ordered AA group within driving distance. And I'm talking about big areas of this country. My little place, I mean, no false modesty or any credit either, but I belong to a pretty strong AA group. It's a group that practices all legacies, 100%. We're a group that has diversity to it in a lot of ways. I'll give you an example of how this plays out in real life. I had somebody call me one time. They were going to be in my town for the weekend. And they asked me if I told them I was going to be gone. They said, well, okay, can you just tell us where there's a good speaker meeting on Saturday night? Well, I could have told them Portland, Oregon, because I know there'll be one, even tonight, in spite of the speaker. But that would have been real handy. But I might as well say Portland, Oregon, because I could not think of a single Saturday night open speaker meeting within 75 miles of where I stood. I knew one, but I wouldn't send my enemy there. I mean, none, because that was just about as ragged a piece of raffle as you could imagine. So there's the real output from that. There's a real fallout from that is extremely troubling. You know, when you've got whole areas that are these free-floating little gatherings that contribute little to that. Let me tell you another way that looks in real life. And then we'll eventually switch into some solution stuff. But I want to get the first step done first. Let me tell you what it looks like in real life. If you look, and assuming that you folks meet the criteria I laid out in the beginning now, if you're concerned about the health and welfare of our fellowship, if you're concerned about the vitality of our program, the integrity of our program, of its ability to respond and be helpful to the next alcoholic who comes in the door. If you're concerned about our wellness, then this might have some import to you. When you look at how we do business, when the way we function, and this is singing to the choir probably in most cases, but I'll say it anyway, we've got a notion that little triangle there. The notion is that in 1955, when we had the International Convention in St. Louis, Bill and all the other sort of historic figures in AA were there, and a historic thing happened that day. Bill, the traditions were in place, they had been implemented enough, and in 1955, Bill said to the gathered members in St. Louis, that he was through as the titular head of AA, and the fellowship was turned over to its members. So how does that work? What was supposed to happen that day, and did happen, at least in the design, is what we call the inverted triangle, meaning that the leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous comes from the membership. That what Bill did was turn it over to the membership to be responsible. And the design is that the group conscience is the driving force in how we make those necessary decisions about what to print, when to print, how much to print, how to respond to help calls for help, how to do public information at a national level, all of the stuff of the program. And the idea was that would be driven from the grassroots. So far, so good, eh? Pretty good way to run a railroad. Well, that's a great theory. But the fact is that as of today, it's more of a myth than a reality. Far more of a myth than a reality. Now, I don't know about Portland, Oregon, or Oregon, but I know about my state. And I've been to every other state. And I've found nothing yet to make me feel any different. That when we meet to express our group conscience, if you look at our General Service Conference, which was held in April, you know, where we send a delegate from all of the designated areas in the country, we look great. We really look good. We would compare with any Fortune 500 company. Meet in executive sessions, in laborious sessions, God knows, debate stuff ad nauseum. And conscientiously try to deal with the needs and the problems that we have as a fellowship. Well, ratchet down. When you get to an area, you see a different picture. Now, you see a fairly deep, typically, the assemblies, you know, where we come together as an area, they'll tend to look pretty decent in terms of how they're run. But when you look at the participation from the groups, it will run about 25% for a long time. It will be in the low 20th percentile of our elected representative. Is that a grassroots group conscience? You know, I would submit to you that what it is a minority opinion. A lot of times we sort of demonize the people who function in the service structure and write them off as politicians. I think that's about as rude and inappropriate a comment as can be made. What we've got is about 20 to 24% of our people who are willing to step forward and take a cut at the ball. And what, 75 to 80% of our population steps back and just ignores the process. Do you see what I'm talking about? Yes. I saw. Now, that's a little bit of the heavy lifting I was talking about. But you think about that in terms of what it bodes for our fellowship. What does it say about our responsibility? Hey, we got a declaration of responsibility. When somebody reaches out for help, we want the hand of aid to be there. What does it say about our level of responsibility? I hope it's troubling to you because it's deeply troubling to me. I tell you one other thing that's troubling about that is of all the concerns I've talked about, I didn't inherit a single one of them. I've been here a long time. Everything that I have indicated happened on my watch. I either helped it happen or failed to take actions to prevent it. So I wasn't a neutral party who sort of had a ship run all that way. It's my ship. I had one of the oars, you know, didn't have but one. But I could have paddled maybe better than I did. So anyway, it's more, and folks like you who not just thinking it is all about you, that it really is about being of maximum service. That it really is about trying to assure that the next one comes in and gets as good as you got, then that's kind of a troubling kind of a concern, eh? It's a lot more, if you're going to think in these terms, you've got to get beyond your own personal preference. If you're going to just operate at your own personal preference, there'll be no leadership whatsoever. But if you're going to try to step out and take action to make a difference, then you got to rise above just personal preference and start thinking of common welfare, the stuff that you guys read about in the traditions. You got to start thinking about common welfare. And so those kind of things that They're kind of troubling. And, well, no, they're not kind of troubling. They're deeply troubling. We've got, I'll just say one other thing in the poor old me mode. And I'll tell you the net impact of that. Alcoholics are impossible to count. I mean, we act like we count. How would you count alcoholics in Portland, Oregon? My God, the best you can do is what they call it, swag. Guess. That's about the best we can do. We say we got somewhere around a couple million members. I don't know who made that up. But I'll tell you how the counting occurs. I was sitting in a meeting one night down in my area. It wasn't my group. I was just sitting there. And they did. Periodically, we do a little nose count survey, and they send out something from the office that says, identify folks who consider your group to be the home group. So they pose that question. Everybody in the room, except me, raised their hand. People from my home group. I mean, same my fellow members, raised their hand. The guy beside me punched me and said, why didn't you raise your hand? You come here. I said, my God, man, it's not my group. You know, I got a group. So how would you count that, eh? We tripled the membership of my county in one meeting. Nobody really knows. The best thinking that I've heard is, well, it's more than thinking, the best statistical presentations that I've heard from the trustees of the fellowship is that for the past good number of years, probably 8 or 10, our numbers for the... I was sitting in assembly one day and listening to the report, and for the first time in my recovery, every number that was presented was down. For the first time in my history in AA, every number. Now I'm talking about members, groups, contributions, literature sale. If we count it, it was down. Now, we tend to not even know it. We tend to pay no attention to it. We don't tend to read that stuff about conference reports and stuff like that. In the real world, they'd call it a recession. Troubling kind of stuff, eh? And so, a whole bunch. The last night, I wanted to see what you guys were doing in Portland, how clean the living was. So I turned on television to the good news. And I just happened to pick up a program, and they were talking about, anybody see a program called RX for Rehab? Oh, you missed it, goody. It was a prescription for rehab. But what they were doing was sort of dealing with celebrities who just sort of been in and out of rehabs and doing postmortems on them. And I tell you what was alarming to me was, you know, here were people who were in the camera because of their celebrity. Nothing to do with their knowledge or awareness or insight or experience. And these folks were citing, one fellow was citing the fact that this whole myth of alcoholism being a lifelong illness was a bunch of junk. Yeah. Well, because of the status of the person, you know, never mind there's no background for that, no research for that. It's just a statement that has impact because of the celebrity of the person. And in the course of it, there was nobody made a direct reference to AA, but about as thinly veiled as you could get. Oh, and there's AA, you know, and there's these step meetings and, you know, this one day at a time stuff, but just sort of in a dismissive kind of a tone. And so, you know, I think there's... I mean, you could take that a whole lot further, but you see what I'm talking about. If you think we're on a roll, good morning. Good morning. Yeah, we've got lots of trouble in River City. And you know, what we do about it, you guess as good as mine. But while I'm guessing, I'm going to be doing the best I can to do something. I hope you will, too. And so what can you do? Well, I told you it was a 4-hour workshop. I'm about to prove it. But But I'd be doing it by myself because I've already told me what time y'all are leaving. And I hate to be here talking to myself. So I'm going to quit when you do anyway. But what you do, that it's a massive looking problem. It is. But my belief, and my buddy in the paper that I'm going to give to Chris for to multiply for the world, is my buddy says the key to it is sponsorship, to bring back that old sponsorship ethic of how people came in. Well, that's a great theory, and I don't argue with that one bit. I do argue with the simplicity of it. We're doing workshops around the country now, how to work with a wet drunk. I'm not sure that's a theoretical exercise. I'm just not confident that we're going to be able to just intellectualize our way into readiness to walk into some rat hole and say, here, let me get hold of you, boy. Go ahead and throw up on me. It's all right. That's hard to teach. And what concerns me is if you have not had that in your experience loop, you'll find that extremely difficult to accommodate. I was speaking to a group in North Carolina. Dave, you just tell me when, and I yield to what you say. I was speaking to a group in North. Whoops, speaking to a group in North Carolina a while back, and a drunk woman came in. It didn't bother me. I thought it looked pretty good. It sort of livened up the place. This gal came in. She was really looped, and she was kind of rattling along, bumping chairs and stuff. Went to the kitchen for some reason, started rattling stuff back there. Well, I was like the psychiatrist at the burlesque show. I was watching the group, you know. I was watching the show. And it's amazing to watch a group of alcoholics, how they respond to a drunk. I might as well have been at the Garden Club or the Kiwanis Club, because I promise you the reaction would have been absolutely no different. There were all of these kind of quizzical looks. Everybody, nonverbal stuff, you know. What are you going to do? I don't know, what are you going to do? You know, somebody do something. Call 911. Well, I mean, what do you know? I mean, you're going to do what you know. And there was one gal there, the oldest person in the group, one gal. She's speaking to my group next month, by the way, as a result of that. She just sort of quietly got up and did what you do if you know what to do. Went back there, put her arm around that gal, said, come on. Took her to another room and talked with her. Well, that's what you do if you know what to do. But if you don't, you do what society does, because that's where we came from. We called Betty Ford or somebody. But anyway, that's where we are. And so, and what we do, when are we striving? You told me what to do.
About 5 till. We'll take a very quick break. Come back to 11.
All right. Good show. And then I'll cheat on your questions just a little bit, and you can build questions into the dialogue. By the way, I love questions. We got a crowded schedule, but I love questions. I think it doubles the value of a workshop. And so I really do like that and hope we'll do it. I just close around this, that this session around that what I think we can do, at least what I do, is try to, number one, I want to be the best member I'm capable of being. I want to be well informed. I want to read current events. I read conference reports. I want to be in tune with what's happening in my fellowship. I want to be as knowledgeable as I need to be so I can be current in the program and not just quote ancient history to everybody. So I want to do that. I want to be a member of a solid group. I want to be a member of a group not only that gives me what I need, but gives me the environment in which I can do my best work. See, I'm no better than the group to which I belong. You know, I don't care how good I might be or whatever in working with an alcoholic. If I can't take him to a group that I'm fully confident can give that person what they need, then I'm selling them a bill of goods. So my group is very much an extension of who I am. They have to deliver on what I promise. And so I want a group that's strong, that will do exactly that, that will know how to be sensitive to a new person coming in, will know how to incorporate them, make them feel welcome. Our group is, by the way, is working on something right now that we've set up a little team to work on sponsorship. We're not satisfied that we've got enough of a encouraging climate for sponsorship. I'm heading up the effort. I got elected to head up the effort. And we're going to build into our environment something that clearly says to people sponsorship's important and the means to provide it. So we're going to build that in. You know. And so that group is tremendously important. I think one of the greatest contributions that I can make is to develop a good group, to make sure that my group is related to the rest of the fellowship. So that my district, I guarantee you, we have to block vote to keep from dominating our district. And we outnumber the folk if we just turn loose. But I want to support that district and help it be strong, my area, and on and on. So there's an awful lot that I can do. It may not invent the cure for cancer or alcoholism, but I can doggone well do some fundamental basic things like that. When we come back, I'll just very quickly share with you, in case there's anybody that's trying to start a group anywhere, or you got aspirations to do it, or you're not satisfied with where you are, I want to tell you how we put one together. That we just celebrated our 10th anniversary, and it's not the group of the year, but it's might be the group of the decade. No, it's just a good, solid group. Anyway, let's take a break. It's hot in here. You have air conditioning? Gee, I got weak. That was typical AA 5 minutes. Yeah, nobody does it quite like us. All right, well, Carl. Wait a minute now. You got to be patient with me. Because I have orders from on high to...
What are the tenets that you'd use for starting a group and having a good group?
Tenets? Yeah. Okay. That's a good... Well, I was going to skip it, but I'll go back to what I was going to say. Let me tell you what we did with the last one we did, and I'll make this real abbreviated. But a lot of times you start meetings or groups over the resentment of coffee pot, the old party line. And an awful lot of times people will start a group just to start one, you know, and then try to figure out how to make it popular. Yeah, and I believe that a group ought to be done for a purpose. And the one I'm in now, I was in a group that I had started many years before, and I took a bunch of people through the steps, to a real long deal, taking folks through the book, and had a great experience. But something happens to folk when they go through an intensive experience like that. They get moved up to a new dimension. And so I had a bunch of folks that had gone through the experience, and they just didn't have a suitable vehicle for their energy. You know what I mean? They had all pumped up and no vehicle, you know. And so they started bugging me about starting a group. Well, I'm the founder of the group I'm in. It's kind of hard for the captain to leave the ship, you know. And so I said, man, I don't want to be starting a group. But they just kept bugging. So I told them, I said, if you want to start a real group, if you want to start a meeting, deal me out. I got no interest. If you want to build a real group, I'll work with you. And so that's how it started. And what we did was... Well, our drill was, and that, by the way, I'll give this to Chris to add to all of his reproduction stuff. This is a little bit of a description of what came out of that. What we did, we had 10 people that wanted to do this, don't want to do this thing. We gathered together, not in a meeting, not in a group, but just as a meeting to talk about starting a group. Met in the back of a guy's shop. He ran a business. We met in the back room of his shop. And so I handled the session. I like brainstorming. One is quick. and you get stuff done, and it's your first thought, and that's usually the best one you ever have. And if you think about it, you screw it up. So I like brainstorming. And so we use the brainstorming procedure. And I ask everybody to identify, if we're going to start a group, what's one characteristic, component, whatever, that you would insist on having in that group? One quality that you would insist on having. And in 12 minutes, we came up with 19 things that were very important to people to do. Well, when we got through with that, that told us exactly how we wanted to develop the group. This is what people are looking for, so we do the group to deliver on that. And what we came up with, we call them goals. They're still crudely written. They're 10 years old, but they're kind of awkwardly written. We haven't changed them. What we did was took those statements and put them into sort of language. And I'll just give you the headings of it. Structure, that would stuff will be planned and carried out. Focus, that we'll target in on what we're dealing with, not wander over the ballpark. Conference-approved literature, not Reader's Digest. Newcomers, be given sound information. We're just talking about newcomers in the program. Probably the most valuable thing we've done in our group, we started a newcomer program. We'll usually have anywhere from 20 to 40 people in that newcomer program. And it's a really great thing. Service is emphasized in the group. We are in service. We're not in theory of service. We are in service. A warm, welcoming kind of an environment. We do that to the best of our ability. Stability, we do what we say we're going to do. That we don't just do herky-jerky stuff. We do what we say we're going to do. That's one of our goals, to do that. Commitments are honored. If you can't do something you say you're going to do, get a replacement. If you can't get one, call on somebody. But we don't have, California, they call it, when you got a commitment, don't show up, they call it a dark night. And we don't want any of those. All members have opportunity to participate in service. One of the things that people said other than the 19 was that they wanted action. They really wanted action. They didn't want to get into study. They wanted to get into action. And so we said everybody can have a job that wants one, and a lot of people get jobs that don't want them. We just put them to work anyway. And so, but that's where we're an active bunch. And if somebody says they can't get a job in our group, they're hiding. You believe that? They try to get a spirit of service. Everybody can't go out and do service like we do a lot of institution work. Some people, just for a variety of reasons, can't go into institution. But they can support. They can applaud. They can provide literature. They can pat the people on the back who are going. You know, so everybody can have a piece of the action. Rotation, sponsorship actively encouraged, and I'm new president of that. Locate the group so it's that could carry out its work and it's accessible to people. We had a lady drop down the stairs of our previous meeting place in a wheelchair. So I guarantee we put that on as a prime goal. First night we met, we had a woman in a wheelchair, and she didn't fall down nothing. So that's kind of important. Meetings planned well. We have a program planning committee. We plan every topic, every leader, every speaker at least a quarter ahead, at least, sometimes 6 months ahead, because we don't want just what we can get. When we get speakers, we want diversity. We want our speakers to look like our population. We want to be good-looking like me, ugly, gay, straight, black, white, brown. We want it to look like America. We want it to look like people. We don't just throw it up and see what happens. Celebrate anniversaries, sense of belonging, minimum one speaker meeting a week. They're tremendously important. I think the open speaker meeting is the purest form of Alcoholics Anonymous. People don't identify with profound insights and wisdom. People identify with where you were broken and healed. And so to open speaker meeting for my money is the purest thing. I tell you one other thing it is. I don't mean to editorialize much with this, but I think is you'll see it tonight in what we do. For many people in early recovery, a Saturday night speaker meeting, especially, is the only social life a couple may have. Most folks are not on a high when they may be high, but they're not on a roll when they come in. And for some, that's the only deal they have. So it's a great opportunity for that, just socializing. And it's also a great place. We believe that alcoholism is a family illness. That's not just a belief. We act on that belief. So at open speaker meeting, we welcome family. We want family to be involved because it's a family illness and the program is a family program of recovery. So we want them to be involved. And primary purpose, that's the name of our group. It's also our job description. That's exactly what we do. And last one and very important, we won't forget Rule 62. And if you don't know, Randall, I don't know if you know Rule 62. Rule 62 is that we don't take ourselves too seriously. So we have a good time at our meetings. It's not unusual for us to sort of kibitz the reader. Just gentle kind of gouging. And so, but we have a good time. But that's what we're doing. So we put a group together. That sounds like a long, tedious process. You know, I bet you we didn't put 2 hours of total planning time. And I don't know how it happened. I'd have no clue. We sent out absolutely no notices, invited nobody. We had over 40 people at our first meeting. At the second meeting, we did it illegally. We had to move out of the room that we meet in a basement of a church. We had to move out of the room they'd given us to a bigger room. We just bogarted it. And we're still there. In fact, they gave us the whole upstairs of the church for our open speaker meeting now. So anyway, it was just that simple. I say simple because most profound things are simple. You know, all we did was say, here's what we're looking for. And then the group answers what you're looking for. So, to me, that's the logical way of starting a group. What are you trying to do? And then that's the planning is very easy once you got the objective in mind. Yeah.
One.
I don't know how much rope I've got. It's enough to hang myself.
Speaking about everything anonymous, if you know someone who claims that they identify with alcoholism, having alcoholism, but they don't drink, they don't have a problem with alcohol, are they an alcoholic, like welcome in the rooms of AA, or not? I mean, I'm confused on that.
They're incredibly welcome at open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. The closed meetings are vitally important. That they're important not because of secrecy so much, but in order to provide the trusting environment that's so critically important for an alcoholic coming in. If you've got a kind of a Duke's mixture of people in a room, alcoholics are not going to open. They're not going to open up. They're not going to feel the trust. And so in closed meetings, it's very important that those be limited to alcoholics, to people who have alcoholism. Open meetings can be a variety of things. You know, that's what they're for.
Right. I agree. And my question is, do you have to drink alcohol to be welcome in AA, or can you identify with alcoholism, you know, having studied the book, been to meetings, claim to have alcoholism, but not have a history of a lot of drinking of alcohol?
You'd have an awfully hard time getting the trust of somebody by saying, you know, I know people who drink. No, that wouldn't do it for a closed meeting.
Okay.
Yeah, that kind of a person ought to come to open meetings. Maybe they'll look out and catch alcoholism. But no, it wouldn't. I know a lot of people who I believe are alcoholics who never had a drink. Mm-hmm. But boy, if they took one, look out. A lot of times I encourage them to. If I go to I do. If I go to a party and I see somebody that just looks like they got the instinct, They better not let me mix them a drink, because I'll have them on their knees before you know it. So I like to get them on in here, though. Yeah, pause. Yes.
This is so valuable. Is there any way we could get an extra hour or so today?
Paul, I'm just a visitor. We got a president over here that's just this hard driver. The group conscience is taking place right now, Paul.
Yeah. Jill, alcoholic.
Yeah, Jill.
Are you discounting treatment?
No, I'm not discounting it at all. I'm somebody who values treatment. And I'm also somebody who's somewhat realistic about it. What we're seeing right now, but you know, just like I said in the earlier session, I really thoroughly appreciated the day treatment came into being. We overrated it a lot. We overrated it with 80% success rates and all this kind of stuff. Nobody's ever had that kind of rate with alcoholism since the world began. Tough illness. So we overrated it, and I value it. The only thing is, it's been an awkward love match in this thing of trying to get this good cooperative relationship. Very frankly, more of it has been on our side of the street than the treatment side. Most of us in this whole era, you know, where we started dealing with this new reality, we quit doing our active outreach stuff. We rarely went to meet with a professional to establish a cooperative relationship. You know what I mean? You know, what we did is back off and sort of had a distance between us. It wasn't a war. It was just sort of a cold distance between the two. But that's more on our side of the street. I'll just give you one other little example about the way we tend to react to this kind of stuff. I was in a group, not the one I'm in right now, but I was in a group preceding that. And a guy came to me one day and said, "We need a group inventory." Well, that's a very unusual request. And I said, "What for?" And he said, "We've got too many addicts in here." And I said, "What are you talking about?" So he said, told me that. I said, "Well, let me take a look and see if I see the same thing. And if so, we'll ask the group about it." So I took a look. What it was, they had a bunch of kids that were in one of those juvenile capturing facilities, you know, where you get wild kids captured and try to brand them and something. And that's what it was. You got everything in the world in those places. And they were loading this van up and bringing them to our meeting. Well, in our effort to make them feel welcome, we were treating them like members. And we were having... The thing you got to keep in mind is kind of the thing you were talking about. AA meetings are conducted by AA members. And what they were doing was getting these kids to read stuff. Well, they're not members. They're just coming in to take a look at it. They don't know whether they're alcoholics or billy goats, for God's sake. But we were doing that. So we had a little meeting and said, "We need to do something," and it's in a steering committee. And they said, "Well, we need to go over and talk to the folk at the facility," and they asked me to do that. So I went over, met with the director, nice young MSW, a fine lady. So I told her we had a little problem, explained what it was. She didn't know what an open or closed meeting was. She had no clue. They don't teach that in MSW programs. How would they know it? See what I'm talking about? It's our responsibility to help establish that cooperative relationship. But what we've done is backed off and expected them to magically understand this stuff. And so we've contributed heavily to this thing of awkward relationship. But no, I don't discount it whatsoever. I believe that good, solid, sensibly. Now, we've got some things that under the treatment banner that are a little strange. So I don't bless everything. They don't need my blessing, but I assure you, I don't bless everything. Hiring escort from AA is not my idea of a treatment program that I endorse, not whatsoever. Violates everything I know anything about. But otherwise, I think a good treatment program probably causes people to get into recovery at least 5 years earlier than they otherwise would. So I value it. But it's just something you have to make a good friend out of it. Yeah. Anybody else? If you don't ask questions, I'll start preaching. Give me some rope, Paul.
Yeah. Oh, here we go.
Thanks, Tom. I'm Rick. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like for you to speak just a little bit about the most recent political decisions on the classification of Alcoholics Anonymous and the backing off of some political or government agencies or treatment centers that no longer say they want to be affiliated with AA because it's now classified as a religion, and what you see down the pike for that.
It is a reality. It's not a new one, by the way. No, this has been. I mean, I'm not an expert on that, but I kind of watch it a little bit. It is a reality that's bubbling to the surface more right now. And God, years ago, there was a. Oh, there never has been a declarative ruling per se, but there have been decisions made that had to do with alcoholism or Alcoholics Anonymous being like a religion. Sometimes that's been beneficial, sometimes it has not. Like in the case of Fifth Steps, for example. You know, there have been a couple of bad cases that got public notoriety. And in those cases, the protection that was given to the Fifth Step was about the same as to the confession in the Catholic Church. So in that case, it was good. It was a good thing. It was protecting against being able to force somebody to testify about that. So it's good and bad. I tell you privately, I kind of appreciate the rulings. I'll abbreviate it. It would be a long kind of a discussion, but I'll abbreviate it. I really think that we have done a 180 over the years in how we deal with alcoholics who are caught up in systems. Years back, courts, for example. Years back, well, if you look at our history, you know a guy named Ebby? Ebby was the guy who, quote, carried the message to Bill. Ebby was a court case. And Ebby came out of court because a good Oxford group couple said, hey, Judge, don't put him in jail, give him to us. And that was the very seedbed for Alcoholics Anonymous. And so then Ebby got Bill. Well, that's an ideal case to me. You know, where we go in, and I've done it myself. I've gone to court and I've petitioned and said, let me have a chance with this. Don't give him a chance. Give us a chance with him. You know, that kind of deal. Well, we're 180 degrees away from that. And what's happened over the years as we've pulled back from our active work with people, you know, of this outreach kind of stuff, the agencies, courts, and name it, mental health centers and treatment centers, they have moved aggressively to bridge the gap, so to speak. And so we've gotten this kind of a mandating quality built into the agencies, which I think's there because of our absence. I really do. And it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's court cases with DWIs, attorneys. You know, I'm doing some work right now with the legal bunch in North Carolina. I spoke at their convention a while back, and I had dinner with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and a couple other justices, and I knew the Chief Justice just from some meetings and stuff. Now, he's not an AA, but when I got up to speak, I mentioned about how awesome it was to be sitting with the Chief Justice and the other justices. I said, if we'd have had dinner together a few years ago, it would have been for my last meal. So they didn't know what I was talking about until I told some of my experience. Then they understood. But it's the same thing, no matter what level, where you've got people sort of captured and mandated into things, it's the same result. And I tell you, I don't mean to belabor it too much, but some of the most lost people that I've known are attorneys trying to get through that maze, and the same with docs. The same thing with docs. God knows it's even more difficult there. where the sanctioning body, in trying to help, owing to our absence, overreach. And so you wind up with the kind of mandating, enforcing forces inside Alcoholics Anonymous, like court papers and stuff like that. That's in the wrong environment. You know, that's putting the enforcement quality inside Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't belong there. But it's them overextending to make up for us not being present, is the way I read it. And so, and that's kind of a long way around that, but that's one reason I kind of welcome that kind of ruling that says you can't mandate folk into this. And I'll be happy with that. Yeah, but what that does, it puts that responsibility even more clearly back in our ballpark. For if we care about the drunk who's caught in the maze, it's up to us to go get them. Yeah.
Have you had any circumstances where they won't allow AA in there because of that?
Wait, just a second now.
Have you had any circumstances where AA now is not able to be affiliated with an institution? Or is that, do you see any of that happening as a result of this because of separation of?
Not much. We had a little bit of it in doing treatment in corrections. We had a little bit of it, but that only said that you can't require people to go to AA. And this came from the Attorney General. And that was fine. I had absolutely no problem with that. Otherwise, I personally don't. Does anybody know of a treatment center where there's been a wall dropped? Because I'm not aware of one in my state.
Portland,
yeah.
Has.
It has happened in Portland in the last quarter of a year.
Well, it also has happened here, and of course I don't know about that. The tell you the thing we've got to think about is. Well, two things. Now, this is just one guy's evaluation. But I think the respect that AA has in the professional community is the lowest I have ever seen it. I mean, ever. And it's just like that program I was talking about. When they, last night, that prescription for rehab or something, it was almost dismissive terms when they talked about AA. We were once viewed as the only game in town. We were viewed as the place to go when you really want help for somebody. Well, this is the place where alcoholics get help. To now, that was just kind of a dismissive kind of, it wasn't dislike, it was just dismissal, just a disregard. And I think that's what we got to recapture. More than whether the wall's down or not, it's how we are seen, and we're judged on what we do. You know, it's the long short of it. I guess if there was a basis for my sermon today, it would be that deep down, I think we've got to get more energy into how we carry this message. We've about gotten out of it. Yeah.
I'm John, an alcoholic. Tom, it seems like in the 80s and 90s, you're talking about the huge influx of treatment. And what it seems to me, in my evaluation, I'm trying not to share, but I'm going to ask you what you think here, that a lot of groups' responses in different parts of the country was kind of tending towards orthodoxy, to just like a lot of spiritual movements have throughout mankind. Have you seen that? Have you seen that as part of our problem, is that rather than just staying close to traditions, we've got a lot of groups that maybe the professional communities and governments and so forth are watching, where we're getting these pockets, almost the way a religion will get a pocket?
Yeah, I have. It's a strange thing that, our society is a strange thing. We're part of it. That it's interesting what we're doing now. That I'm no sociologist, but if I were, my interpretation would be that we went through this wide open, go get them period in that first 25, 30 years of our existence, and it was gung ho. And we were totally wide open, and nothing mattered except getting the job done and that kind of thing. And then we went through this sort of gray zone there, you know, where we moved radically different, moved away from this real active work with other alcoholics, started letting other people be in the primary source of how folks got affiliated in AA. And we lost a lot of our compass in there. The thing I was kind of alluding to in the earlier session, that everything anonymous, that's real. That is very real. There are places in this country that make no pretense. Like the question you asked, if you had asked that question in places I could name in America, they would have said, oh, yeah, sure, that's fine. They would have readily said that. If you had said, is it okay for a heroin addict to come here? I guarantee you, in this country, you find big regions of this country where the folks would say, yeah, that's fine. That's everything anonymous. Well, I will assure you that everybody's program is nobody's program. And so what we do is wind up just sort of generalizing to the point that we missed the boat. And what we looks to me like we're doing is we've gone through that kind of period and we've reaped that crop. And now what it looks to me like we're doing in that righteousness you're talking about, we have a movement started of super righteous AA. And nobody's imposing on us. We're just doing it. We've got people that are doing, like I belong to the Primary Purpose Group. That's the name of my group. There's a movement called Primary Purpose as well. You know, and that we are not in that movement. You know, we are one group that follows the primary purpose, the primary purpose. And so you got this overcorrection of super righteous, hard line, back to basics, let's do it like we used to do it. You got that hard movement. Well, that may sound good, but I'm not sure how realistic it is. That I think it's really important to sort of look at where we are and start looking at how we can change. You got to have leadership to develop change. You can't impose change on people. If you want to see how we react, try to give a mandate to this crowd and watch what happens. You'll empty a room so quick, it'll swim. You can't do it. Yeah, and I think what we've got to do, rather than these sort of swings, pendulum swings from wide open to super rigid, I think we've got to do is take a look at where we are. And take a look at what we can do. I just tell you this, I am aware of that. And there's an awful lot of stuff. In fact, the thing that I'm going to give Chris is, he's not a part of that, but a lot of people are into this sort of thing of commentary about awful conditions. But what's really lacking is about what kind of actions can you take to make a difference. I met a week or so ago with, I've got a bunch in my sponsorship, a bunch that are fairly close to me. And we meet every couple of years. They just want to meet, and it's not a mandatory show up, but it's sort of a group sense when they want to meet. And there's always a purpose, and we meet for a day. And so this time, and we spent a full day on steps 6 and 7 one day. I never knew how much was in 6 and 7 until we spent a whole day and saw how tremendously important it was. This time, the guys wanted to deal with how do you go beyond just your own development, kind of like we're talking about here today. How do you go beyond just your own development into further growth, so that you can do something beyond your own shadow? Yeah. And so we had a fascinating day. One of the things that we identified was the kind of thing we're talking about here this morning, about the need for solid groups in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so we were talking, we romanced the problem, and then we started looking at solutions. And so we came up, we're not going to revolutionize the world. But we left that day with some notions of what we're going to do. I won't go into all that stuff right now, but that's what, I think that's what's got to happen. Is that it's enough, we got enough critics and enough folks that are declaring doomsday and that, something's got to change. What we're lacking is people who will step up to the plate and say, start with me. And that's what we're hungry for, is to folks that be, and that's why I'm talking to y'all. That I hope you'll catch a little germ from this and take a look. If you're not happy with the environment you're in, do something about it, for God's sakes. Do something about it. And so, to me, that's what's missing is. Whoops, back row.
You can take one more question.
Now, he said quick. I didn't say it. Dave said it. If you're going to break on somebody, break on him. You got.
Hi, my name's Nancy. I'm an alcoholic. My question is, how do you invite a treatment center into your meeting, because we've been approached a couple of times, and keep that singleness of purpose?
Number one, I don't want to invite a treatment center in. I think I know what you're talking about. And we get patients from treatment centers who come in to our group. And I think that's what you're talking about, like those kids coming in. Very frankly, we've had no problem doing that, because, my God, they just come and break down the door. Our problem is just sort of making sure we work it out. And so my experience has been that if you go and meet with the director of the facility, or whoever the senior person is, and say, we've got to tell you one thing, start a newcomer meeting. I guarantee you they'll be there the next week. They will be there. I will guarantee you, because that's just. Yeah. Well, they'll usually respond to an invitation, because they go to enough places where we are not all that receptive, where we just practice benign neglect or something. I tell you a thing about people coming out of facilities. It's a strange thing about living in a confined area, in a restricted area. It's hard to get people out of that. If you watch when people come to your group from the facility, unless they're really a loose deal, they'll look like soldiers. They'll come in formation almost. They'll be walk in a cube, come in, and they'll all sit together. Yeah, my God, they've been together all day. You'd think they'd want to scatter, but they don't. It's that herd instinct. They'll just come in and sit. We actually spend time figuring how to break it up. Yeah. Now, I'll go over and sit down in the middle of where the women come in from a women's halfway house. And I'll go over and sit down in the middle. I'll go over in front of them and direct the choir and lead them in Amazing Grace. Since they're going to sit in formation, we might as well put them to work. But, trying to break them up. Because when they come, they might as well stay where they were. Because they're not having, just what's said at a meeting is just one little piece of it. The chemistry of interaction, of rubbing shoulders with folks, with getting to know people you don't know, that's the magic. And so when we do it, that's the thing we like to do, is get them to come in and be as much part of the group as they possibly can, and not just some fresh meat to beat on, that. So, ask them is what I found. It works like magic. That's it. Dave said that's it. Thank you.